Today's Teisho will be on case 100 in the Book of Serenity. Case 100 is entitled Longyan's Mountains and Rivers. Introduction. One word can cause the nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. This drug can kill people and bring people to life too. The benevolent, seeing this, call it benevolence. The wise, seeing this, call it wisdom. But tell me, where does the benefit or harm lie? A monk asked Master Langya Zhao, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? Langya said, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce the mountains, the rivers, and the great earth? Verse. Seeing existence without considering its existent. Turning the hand over and back. The man of Langya does not fall behind Gautama. So I want to thank everybody for sitting so well this morning. Some of you are online, and I'm very glad you're here, and some of you are here in the Zendo, this beautiful place. This place is getting, I think Murray Grove gets more and more beautiful, and it's just wonderful to be here. Some of you are going to be arriving here later in the week, and I'm eager to see you, and some of you will be participating online, and I'm very glad to see you also. You know, this is our May-June session, and it's 7 days. And I understand that people can't necessarily be here all 7 days, but, you know, the seven-day session is really like the classic. This is like the classic Zen session. So for thousands of years, actually, you know, almost 2,000 years, people have been doing session like this. And, you know, actually the Mandarin word for session is Chanqi, is a Zen seven, right? Zen seven. So we're doing a Chanqi, we're doing a Zen seven, the classic session. So the ancestors are sitting with us. So this is a really interesting koan. I have been doing a lot more teaching than I have in the past. I used to have an administrative job, and so I would teach every semester, but now I'm teaching a lot, and I am interacting with students a lot more than I used to. I had like 90 students this semester, and got all my papers done. I don't know how, but I did. And you know, I have a chance sometimes to go to lunch with students, which is something I never used to have time to do. And I had a chance to go to lunch with this one student who actually was in my class a couple years ago and has now graduated. He's finished college, and he basically is trying to be a writer. And he wanted to talk to me about it. He's decided he's going to go to a creative writing program, maybe the University of Iowa. There are some very famous creative writing programs that have produced, you know, some novelists and poets of real distinction. And he met with me because he really enjoyed my class. We had a short fiction, short story class together about 3 years ago. And I think he was a senior at that time, and he had other career plans. But he's taken this step, and he said his parents are very worried about him. You know, education is really expensive, and he got out of college, and they were waiting for him to start his career. And he had a career basically lined up and started working, but he was, he was just completely unenchanted by what he was doing. And I guess he's sort of taken the off ramp from his career, and he's decided to go to this creative writing program. Maybe, as I said, there's one in Iowa that's very, there's a number of them that are really quite excellent. And his parents are upset with him because, you know, they love him. They want him to be happy. You know, they were very happy to see him do so well in school. He was a double major, right? He was an English major and some kind of engineering, right? So they were very happy to see him take English. It's fine, you know. And they expected him to get out of school and maybe become an engineer. My nephew and my niece are both engineers. You know, he was looking forward to seeing his son do that. And his son taken this route. If I were the father or the mother, I would be worried too, right? Because, you know, when we had lunch, basically he wanted to talk to me about literature, and he was, I think, looking for some support. Because in a certain way, he knew that what he was doing was kind of crazy. You know, he really has sort of like burned some of his bridges already. And, you know, we talked about it. You know, he's writing short stories, and he's just written this short story. We talked about writers he likes. He likes Cormac McCarthy. He's a pretty dark writer. And he's working hard. He's putting a lot of hours writing these stories. And he wanted me to take a look at it. And I haven't yet. I said I would. I asked him to send me a copy. The point is, I was straight with him. I said, you know, the world is full of writers who, writers who didn't become writers, right? The world is full of writers who decided they wanted to be a writer went off the exit ramp and tried to write the great American novel. And I said, you know, please realize that it's very likely your novel is not going to get published. And I said, you know, I told him famous stories about writers who barely were almost unable to get published. James Joyce, the great Irish writer, had a very hard time finding somebody to publish Dubliners, his masterpiece. You may know that, you know, John Steinbeck, when he was trying to find a publisher for Grapes of Wrath, he went to 27 people or something. He actually got down on his knees and begged somebody to publish this novel. Stephen King said that he actually covered his walls like wallpaper with rejection slips. He'd just get up, get a rejection slip, and get back to his typewriter. There are these wonderful stories about Cormac McCarthy is a good example of somebody who, you know, basically wrote these novels, which are really masterpieces, But he made almost no money. He lived on a farm. They didn't even have, he and his wife didn't even have running water. They used to bathe out in the pond. There was a pond behind their house. And you know, basically he made extraordinary sacrifices for years and years. So I said, you know, realize that for every McCormick McCarthy, for every Gabriel Garcia Marquez, there's a lot of people who maybe followed their dream, but they didn't get published. And he said, I understand that. You know, so there's no guarantee. This doesn't happen, doesn't necessarily mean he's going to write The Grapes of Wrath, right? And he's going into an uncertain future. You know, it reminded me of another story, another person I knew I had a administrative assistant whose daughter was a straight A student in high school, and she was just, I think she was a valedictorian of her high school here in central New Jersey. I think South Plainfield, as a matter of fact. And her mother didn't, you know, really get a great education. She was my administrative assistant, very hardworking person. And, you know, her daughter was her pride and joy, right? And her daughter was this super good scholar, got into Rutgers like for almost, well, Judy works at Rutgers, so her daughter could go for free. But her daughter got these other like scholarships, really wonderful deal. And then she saw her daughter, sort of, her daughter was in accounting, wanted to be an accountant. And her daughter began to make all of these decisions, which were not what Judy had planned. And some of them were very unwise decisions, right? You know, Judy's daughter ran up a big secret credit card debt, right? She bought a car, you know. She met somebody that Judy really disliked, and eventually they married and had two kids. And Judy was just torn apart by this because she had these dreams for her daughter, and maybe the parents of my student are feeling the same way about their son, right? They had all these plans, and I asked this guy when we were having lunch, this student of mine, you know, what made you do this? And it was so interesting because, you know, he just said, I couldn't believe in what I was doing. And I couldn't believe in what I was doing. And I thought that was such an interesting thing to say. I think that's what happened to Judy's daughter too. You know, I think she was a straight A student in high school. She was in college and she couldn't believe in what she was doing anymore. And then she began, you know, to make some decisions that her mother didn't approve of and probably made some really big mistakes. I think she and her husband are divorced now, you know. You know, for a parent, it must be very frightening to see your child, you know, do this. And I've known other people, too, who are like this, who... you know, you could say their lives were going along so well, and then something happens, right? And it's like they look around and they realize, I just don't want to be part of this world. You know, a writer that I like very much is a guy named Henry Miller. And if you read some of his books, interesting books, right? Because Henry Miller grew up in Brooklyn. His father was a German immigrant and a tailor. And his parents were like these super hardworking Protestant people. And Henry, this was a time when most people didn't go to college. This was before World War I. But they were hoping their son would make something of his life. And he was working for what used to be called the Bell Telephone Company. And he had gotten married when he was young and had a daughter. And he writes, he has this book, it's called The Tropic of Cancer, I believe. And he says, you know, I was doing everything I was supposed to do, and then I suddenly turned like 43 years old, and I couldn't believe in any of this. Right? It's just like, I couldn't believe in any of this. And then what he did was really irresponsible, right? I mean, really like totally irresponsible. He decided he wanted to be a writer. And he actually left his wife and his child, and he started writing novels and borrowing money from people. And he eventually went to Paris. He actually left the United States and went to France and taught English in France. It's like totally irresponsible thing to do, right? These are people who are going along in life and they're doing what is expected of them. And all of a sudden they go through this crisis where they look around and nothing seems real. And my friend, this my young friend, my former student, you know, hopefully he will do what I recommended, which is go and not stay in a solitude and try to write the great American novel, but go find some mentors who can help him. If he does that, I think he'll be okay. If he doesn't, I don't know what's going to happen. And my administrative assistant's daughter is now, I think, in her, you know, she's like 45 or maybe she's even 50, right? Henry Miller is no longer alive. And, you know, somebody like Miller is really dangerous, right? I mean, somebody who is living a life and then, you know, basically walks out on all of it and does something totally crazy, leaves his wife, leaves his family. That's really bad. But then when you think about it, you know, in India, 2,600 years ago, there was a person who, according to legend, was a prince. Probably not really a prince. He was probably the son of the Speaker of the House of the Parliament in the Shakya Republic. But, you know, later on, a Republican political traditions died in India, and Siddhartha Gautama's father was remembered as a prince. You know, he was doing everything he was supposed to do. You know, his father trained him probably to be a member of the aristocracy of his society. You know, in his speeches, the Buddha often talks about his riding horses. Horsemanship was really important for the Shakya people. Also, actually like martial arts, you know, part of the Buddha's training. Statecraft, right? The Buddha married a daughter of another distinguished family. They had a little son. And then one day he realized none of this is real. I can't go forward with this. See? That was frightening. In the sutras, in the Pali sutras, it says that when the Buddha left his house, his mother and his, it doesn't mention his wife, but I'm sure she was crying too, but it says his mother and his father were sobbing. So this is, you know, this is really interesting. Henry Miller is a bad man, You know, he did a bad thing, and I think it is a bad thing. But I sometimes think that what happens to people is that they are going along in reality, in the so-called reality. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They're being good citizens. They're being good fathers, mothers, teachers. And they get up one day and none of it seems real. And that's a dangerous moment, right? It's a dangerous recognition. How does it say here? It says, this drug can kill people and can bring them to life too. So you know, we try, I think, sometimes to avoid having this recognition, right? But sometimes it creeps in on us, right? So, you know, maybe you've had this experience where you have been working hard for something and you finally get it, right? So one thing I worked hard in my life to do was to get a PhD in English. And I worked really hard. I mean, you know, I spent many nights working all night. I spent countless hours writing these papers that never saw the light of day. When I was writing my dissertation, I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would think, where is this going? You know, where is this going? And I would be so afraid that I was, you know, heading off a cliff with my arguments. And I would take my chapters of my dissertation to my committee, and the committee members would read it, and you know, I'd be so nervous waiting for their approval, or so worried about their disapproval. And this was like a project that consumed, you know, something like 5 years of my life, right? Since maybe 6 years of my life. And, you know, finally I finished the dissertation, and I had my final exam, right, where you just go in and discuss your dissertation. And I had imagined that when this happened, I would feel something powerful, like this, you know, your sense of accomplishment. But actually, when it happened, nothing. I didn't feel depressed. I was glad I had my PhD, but I was waiting for like some deep experience, and nothing happened. It was just like nothing. It was just like another day. I remember reading, you probably haven't heard of this guy, there was a guy named Ted Turner who started cable television, basically, and made like, at the time, he was one of the richest men in the United States. And I remember reading an interview with him, and he said, you know, he had grown up really, really poor in an abusive family. And his goal was to become like a millionaire. He eventually became, he started CNN and basically, he invented cable television. He made billions. And his goal was to become like a millionaire, but he, you know, the more money he made, the more he... And he said that he finally made $1 billion. And he said he thought he should be excited about it, so he drove home. And he went into the kitchen and he said to his wife, you won't believe this, but I am now worth $1 billion. And his wife said, oh, you know, that's nice, you know. Like, you know, I have real problems, you know, I have people coming for dinner. And he tried to tell people, look, I've got I've made $1 billion. No, it's like, yeah. And then he realized he didn't care. He didn't care. It was this thing, you know, he was going for all these years, and then he had $1 billion in it. Suddenly it was like nothing, nothing. I've had many experiences like this. I don't know, maybe it's just me. You know, I worked so hard to write my first book. I was so worried. And I write publishers, and I was agonizing. And I worked on that book so many hours a day. I would write so many hours a day that, you know, my back, I couldn't find a posture where my back was comfortable. And I was so, you know, I started losing weight because I would just get up, go sit, go for a jog, and work on my book. And then I'd go to sleep, and then I'd get up. And that went on and on. I felt so burned out. And when I finished the book, I sent it off to the publisher, and there were problems. There were typesetting errors. You know, getting the galleys correct was a big headache. There were lots of problems with that. You know, I finally got a copy in the mail, and you know, I thought when I get this copy, I'll go, ah, my book. And it was like, I think that's so interesting. I think that's so interesting. I know people who are like at the end of their careers, right? People my age. And when they look back at their life of accomplishment, so-called, you know, they want to say, you know, this is, you know, but when they actually look at it, it's like it just disappears in front of them. Now, you know, this is an aspect of reality, right? Aspect of reality that we normally repress. And we're afraid of it because, some people respond by abandoning their wife and child and going off to Paris to become a great writer. And we're maybe afraid that if we recognize this, we'll do the same thing. You know, we'll suddenly just start falling through the clouds. You know, everything becomes meaningless. And now we're lost, and we have no sense of direction. And you know, people go through that crisis too. You know, most people don't let themselves look at this, right? You know, they write their book and they put it on the shelf and it's in a special place. But I think there's a little bit of a moment where people realize that what they were expecting to happen doesn't happen. And what happens instead is that everything kind of like disappears. So we thought, you know, you're elected something, President of the United States, and you think, I'm going to, and then you realize, it's like it disappears. And I think we all have these moments where, you know, we encounter like this strange emptiness, or this strange emptiness. And, you know, we respond to that in various ways, you know, but I think it's happened to all of us. Things that should have been like moments of connection or moments of ratification or, you know, like, now I've done it. You know, the moment happens and there's just nothing there. And that can be terrifying. But it's also the beginning of wisdom, of liberation. See, I think Buddhism is very interested in that moment. I think Buddhism is not only just interested, but it says that is a dangerous place to be in, but it's also where you have to go if you want to be liberated. And, you know, if you, once you've had that experience, and probably you have, you can cover it up, or you can explore it. Right? And if you don't explore it, it could really become destructive. Right? A lot of behavior. I mean, when we look at our society, we see all of these people who clearly don't believe in anything. Right? So, I think Donald Trump is a totally cynical person. I think he knows it's all nothing. Right? So for him, it's just about power and manipulating people because he's so afraid of it. Right? And I think a lot of corruption in the United States, a lot of the destructive behavior is because these people have really figured this out. They really know it's not real. They're all, they go to church and they know it's a farce and they don't believe a word of it in somewhere inside, right? And they don't know what to do with that. And it's very unhealthy for our society. But what Buddhism says is you've got, that's really there and you've got to come to terms with it. And it's not a disaster. It's the path to liberation. Right? It's a path to liberation. So, we grow up thinking that this world that we live in is real, right? So, when I was a kid, when I went to elementary school, there was an older kid, I can't remember his name now, but I just idolized him, right? And he was like, I don't know if you remember, there used to be these people who would wear these, they were called safety patrol. They were students who would get a special belt. It was this belt they would wear over one of their shoulders and it would buckle around their waist. And their job was to get to these school crossings early, and they went through some training, and they were supposed to stop the children from crossing on the crosswalks when traffic was coming, right? And at any rate, they were supposed to guide the little kids across the street. And this kid was a safety patrol. And I so admired him. I would wait and, he would, and he was, in so many ways, he just seemed like the fulfillment of a human being to me. He dressed in, so he was kind of a cool kid. He was maybe 3 or 4 years older than I was. And, he didn't want to be my friend, but I remember I idolizing him. And I just thought, I think in my childish way, I thought, if I could just be that guy. And I realized, later on, I think I was trying to have people like me by being like the people I admired. I thought they were real in a way that I wasn't real. It's like a secret. We look around and we say, maybe in our hearts we say, I'm not real, but he's real. Because look, everybody likes him. But often in his heart he's thinking, God, I don't feel real at all, right? And everybody covers this up, but actually it's like everywhere. When you begin to look, most people don't feel real. Most people's accomplishments feel real only from the outside, and when they have them, actually sometimes there's this feeling that none of this is real. And actually, for Buddhism, this moment, though dangerous, is the most important moment of one's life, this insight. See? If the world we live in isn't real, then what's real? And Buddhism says, Zen is Buddhism. Buddhism says, don't back away from that experience of emptiness. Don't be afraid of that experience of emptiness. And indeed, if you've come to here, if you've come to Sesshin online or in person, you already know that what I'm saying is true. You've already had these like intimations of emptiness, right? You know, last night I said, something brought you here. You know, something inconvenient as it was to drive down here, and many people had to make arrangements for people to take care of their responsibilities while they're gone, or, you know, pets have to be cared for and so on, all of these things. You know, and yet something made you come down here. And part of that something is realizing that, you know, the world that we live in, the world that we imagine to be real, is not real in the way we imagine. And if you think about it, you know, actually, this is frightening, but so much of what we do is driven by a compulsive fear of not being real. And one of the problems is that, you know, actually, we keep trying to be real, and the more we try, in a strange way, the more unreal things become for all of us, right? So, you know, people, I was just reading about this land dispute where there's this forest, and the Nature Conservancy is trying to buy the forest, and there was this builder who's trying to build, cut the forest down and build these houses. And, you know, his motive might be, his short-term motive is money maybe, but I also think, you know, this is how he defines himself as real. You know, it's like, if I can build this apartment complex, I'm real. And of course, I would say what he's going to do is incredibly destructive. But he's kind of a desperate man, right? So often, when you really probe the motivations of people, there's a kind of desperation. Well, if this isn't real, what the hell is real? See, you know, that experience of unreality, that intimation of unreality, is the beginning of liberation. You know, and so we Zen people, we Buddhists, uniquely, I think, I don't know any other tradition of wisdom that says quite the same thing, right? I mean, there's definitely religions that say, you know, doubt is a very big problem. You know, I'm losing my faith, Doubt is a big problem, you know, don't give way to doubt. Buddhism says, please give way to doubt. You know, the problem is people don't give way to doubt enough, actually. They don't give way, you don't trust doubt enough, actually. That's the Buddhist view. You know, people become not nihilists, right? They don't believe in anything, almost, and then they embezzle money. Well, they're not really, they haven't really embraced emptiness, right? If they did, they wouldn't bother to embezzle that money. So they're just cynical or half-hearted embracers of emptiness. We Buddhists go all the way. You know, we go all the way. And, you know, this is scary to say because it's so important to, I mean, I have a job. You know, I that's how I define myself. I'm an English teacher, English professor. I go to work. I like my students to like my classes. I don't say, oh, it's all meaningless. But this issue of emptiness being there all the time is really something we have to face. And the Buddhist teaching is that if we go deeply into that emptiness, it doesn't have the destructive consequences we fear. It's profoundly liberating. You know, we experience a deep connection to things. You know, actually, like emptiness is what connects us, is really the human word for what connects us all, right? And when we're not interacting with the world from this place of like fear and attachment, compulsive fear and attachment, we can interact in a totally different way. So, you know, when I interact with the, how does Koan put it? With the mountains, the rivers, and the great earth, you know, from my usual mentality, my motivations are fear and attachment, basically, right? That's the motivation of the guy who cuts the forest down and builds an apartment complex. People need a place to live, of course. But, you know, what are his motives? Is it, you know, I would say at some level it's really fear and attachment. But you know, if we go through emptiness, you know, we experience the mountains, the rivers, and the great earth in a totally different way, you know, as inseparable from ourselves. See? And so, you know, Buddhist practice, and especially Zen, puts the experience of emptiness front and center. Right? It's the center and core of our path to wisdom. It's true for all Buddhism, but you know, Zen just puts it right there on the table from the get-go. So, you know, we are all here today because we've had some intimations of the meaninglessness of existence. Yes, the meaninglessness. Meanings are just things we invent, and often they're driven by fear and attachment. That's the Buddha's view. There's something deeper than meaning. There's something deeper than purpose, even, right? And, you know, when we cling to things, they turn to dust in our hands. And when we don't cling to things, they come alive. So the Zen path is, you know, not clinging, right? And not clinging means sitting in deep mushin and working through our fears and our attachments one by one. And, you know, and encountering the mountains, the rivers, and the great earth as our body. And the Buddhist view is that this is only done by not running away from these intimations of emptiness, but by going straight ahead. So this is day one of our sesshin, and here we are. Something has told us to come here. Sometimes that has felt like fear, and it's like fear of this meaninglessness of things, right? And things are indeed meaningless because meaning is just something we've invented. There's something greater than meaning. Introduction. One word can cause a nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. This drug can kill and can bring people to life too. The benevolent, seeing this, call it benevolence. The wise, seeing this, call it wisdom. But tell me, where does the benefit or harm lie? Case. A monk asked Master Lang Jia Zhao, purity is originally seen. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? See, that's his question. So he's asking, basically, you know, I've been told that purity is originally so, but look at this world. Right? Now look, the monk is speaking from the standpoint of somebody who has not deeply experienced emptiness. And Lang Ya says the same thing. Purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? But the meaning is totally different now. See, because he's gone through the door of Wuxin. before I was awake, I saw mountains as mountains and rivers as rivers. And then, you know, I saw that mountains were not mountains and rivers were not rivers. And now I see mountains as mountains and rivers as rivers. See? So step one, step two, step three, the door of emptiness changes everything. Verse, seeing existence without considering it real, turning the hand over and back, so like two sides of your own hand. The man on Mount Lanya does not fall behind Gautama.